There is a murder up in the trees of Sunnyvale, California. Yes, a murder of crows has moved into this sleepy little Silicon Valley town. And that murder has everybody in town wondering, once a murder moves into town, can it be moved back out?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned in to the 1,302nd edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends down there in Tepique who are tuned into the Food Chain podcast at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, I was raised up in the high prairies of Montana, very near the Crow Indian Reservation. Now, while growing up a boy under the big sky, I became fascinated, as boys once did, with the Plains Indians and their culture. When we played cowboys and Indians, I was an Indian. But one thing puzzled me about my Crow Indian neighbors. Why, I wondered, did they name their tribe after a pesky black bird that nobody seemed to enjoy having around? Why not name your tribe the Eagles, or Bears, or maybe even the Wolverines? It wasn't until much later that I learned how intelligent, demanding, and even domineering a murder of crows can be. And now I know why my neighbors named their tribe after this intelligent, demanding, and domineering bird. And you know what? I suspect this lesson is something that the city fathers and mothers of Sunnyvale are learning, because a murder of crows has moved into their town, and now they are all asking, once a murder of crows moves in, can it be moved back out? Well, here to help us find an answer, we have Glenn Phillips, who is the executive director of Golden Gate Audubon Society. Glenn, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thanks for having me on today.
Now, we understand that you are a fan of crows, too.
I am indeed. I actually have a pair of crows that make their home in my backyard. I've actually named them Crowbert and Crowella. And I can usually tell who's who when they're standing right next to each other, because Crowella is just a little bigger than Crowbert, which is fairly common for many birds, that the females are just a little bit bigger. They have, you know, a little more work to do with the egg-laying responsibilities. So.
And they have to boss the males around too, right?
Well, they seem pretty egalitarian, I would say. crows are, you know, they really work as a team, which is, I think is part of what sort of sets up the challenges that we're having with crows today, is because they are very social creatures. They interact, with their pairs will stay together for a long time. The offspring of the year will stay with their parents for a long time, which is fairly unusual for birds. Mm-hmm. Most species will, you know, as soon as the young are flying and are able to feed for themselves, they're really on their own. But crows hold on to their family members, you know, for a little longer. They can actually help raise the next generation. And so it enables them to adapt to changing environments in a way that is pretty unique among birds.
Why murder?
You know, that's a very good question. I don't really know the answer to that. My suspicion would be that it probably has something to do with the sort of, because there are, you know, black birds that, you know, in Western culture, black and white have, you know, have come to be stand-ins for good and bad. And so I think that as black birds, as in some ways they historically have been crop pests, right? They feed on many of the same things that humans feed on. So you kind of don't want them in your garden or in your farm. And so I think that sort of association with, you know, bad news has followed them around, undeservedly, I think.
Well, okay. Well, let's back up a little bit. And first of all, you're part of the Audubon Society, so I have to ask, Can one be a fan of crows and songbirds at the same time?
Well, I certainly am. It is one of the challenges of having crows in your backyard is that, you know, crows are opportunistic feeders, so they will eat whatever they can. And that includes eggs and, you know, chicks of other birds. So I can tell you that, you know, the crows come in the spring to wash their food in my bird bath, and I have routinely found, you know, along with, you know, lizards and half of a worm, you know, the occasional, you know, bird chick has ended up, you know, soaking in my bird feeder. And while that can be a little distressing in the moment, you know, these are the natural predators of songbirds. I mean, they have co-evolved with the other songbirds that live here. And so you know, birds have their own defenses to deal with it. I don't think that crows are, you know, particularly causing trouble for other species.
Okay. I had to ask that for my wife, who is a songbird fan, and though so very protective of her little songbirds. And so when the crows come around, you know, a frown crosses her face, and you can see that she's looking out for the little ones. You're, as I said, a member of the, in good standing of the Audubon Society. I remember the Audubon because when I was just a wee tyke in grade school, I was assigned to do a story about birds. So I sent away to the Audubon Society for asking for some pictures of birds. And boy, did I ever get pictures. So tell us a little bit about the Audubon Society and your stay in New York City, too.
Well, so I'm currently the executive director of Golden Gate Audubon, and Golden Gate Audubon is over 100 years old. It's one of the longest standing conservation groups in the Bay Area, and we were founded as the Audubon Society of the Pacific, you know, back in the day, really before National Audubon was an organization. That was when National Audubon was the National Association of Audubon Societies, because there were all of these amazing grassroots organizations around the country working to protect birds, and over the years that organization sort of grew and matured, and the National Audubon Society was founded from that. That movement, and while we take our name from John James Audubon, the painter, who is problematic in his own way, you know, really the movement was not really connected with him, except to the extent that his drawings of birds sort of represented the diversity and beauty of North America's birds.
Mm-hmm. He was somebody who truly appreciated birds, as only an artist or a painter could, perhaps, and studies them to that extent. So you were in New York City. Tell us the difference between birds in New York City and birds in the San Francisco Bay Area.
Well, you know, it's not really that different. You know, San Francisco and New York both are, you know, are places where they're sort of major metropolitan areas with very large pockets of natural places that dot the landscape. They're places that are both on major harbors, right? San Francisco Bay, New York Harbor, and I think although I think people think of New York as only having, you know, rats and pigeons, there are actually about as many bird species in New York as there are in the Bay Area, and that's largely because both the Bay Area and the New York area lie sort of in the middle of a major migratory route. So New York City and San Francisco are about halfway to the far north, to Alaska here in the west, and to, you know, boreal Canada in the east, where hundreds of millions of birds are migrating from Central and South America, you know, all the way to the Arctic Circle. And so both New York and San Francisco sort of catch the middle of that. And what that means is that not only do we get the amazing birds that sort of that live in each place year-round, we also get this spectacle of all these new species that pass through the cities every year. But we also, because we're sort of in the middle, we're, for some of the northernmost species, we are south for the winter. And so both New York and San Francisco have large numbers of wintering species that, you know, that we see all winter long that some other parts of the country don't necessarily get. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the joys and of bird watching in both of these places is you have your winter friends, you've got your summer friends, and you've got your year-round friends.
I once did a radio show about unintended consequences, and one of those unintended consequences was how starlings were introduced into the United States via Central Park in New York City. Have you ever heard that story?
Yes, you know, Shakespeare was a very big thing at one point. I mean, you know, he still is.
Yeah.
And you know, his work is extraordinary. And I think that, you know, that there was this, at one time, this feeling that, you know, that you couldn't really appreciate Shakespeare if you didn't, you know, sort of understand the bits and pieces that were everyday experience for people in England, but that might not be for people in North America. And so to bring some of those experiences along, they introduced to many parks, not just Central Park, but to many parks across the country, European bird species, nightingales and starlings and the like. And unfortunately, the starlings did manage to survive and thrive here. And in fact, I think there are probably more starlings today in North America than there are in Europe.
Great clouds of them, as a matter.
Yeah,
of
fact, right? You know, and they are pesty birds. You know, they also like crows and some other species, mostly blackbirds, although these are not closely related. They feed on grain and other, you know, crop mm-hmm. wastes, and so they can be, you know, pests to fruit and grain crops. Mm-hmm. And they have the added disadvantage here in North America that they're very aggressive birds with not a lot of predators here. They didn't evolve here, and so they are very good at stealing nesting habitat from cavity nesting birds like bluebirds and woodpeckers. And and it's, you know, it was very sad in New York outside my office window when I worked at the Prospect Park Audubon Center. I watched a pair of red-bellied woodpeckers excavate a nest in the tree right outside my window, and in Prospect Park in Brooklyn, and then I watched a group. It was about seven starlings chase the woodpeckers out of the hole and nest there successfully.
And that's the way of it. And when it gets right down to it, that's kind of what the good folks in Sunnyvale, California, are forced to cope with right now. A murder of crows has moved into town, and the city fathers and the city mothers are looking at all of these crows. And I guess the complaint is that it's the second most troublesome thing in Sunnyvale next to speeding cars. And so when we come back, we're going to pick up the crow and talk about how it becomes so domineering. This is the Food Chain Radio program. Today, Michael Olson is hosting Glenn Phillips, who is the executive director of the Golden Gate Audubon Society. And we are wondering, once a murder moves into town, can it be moved back out? Right back.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Welcome back. Yes, we're talking about crows, a murder of crows. Maybe many murders of crows that have moved into Sunnyvale, but not just Sunnyvale, lots of cities around the country. Why do crows move into town in winter, Glenn?
Well, you know, crows, during the nesting season, you know, crows will disperse into the landscape because they need to have room for their nests, to raise their young. They don't really want to have, you know, neighbors that close. They're in some ways like people. They sort of like to, you know, when they want to raise their family, they want a little extra room.
They want a nest.
Yeah. But when they're done with that, I think this is something that I often discover when I'm talking to people about birds, particularly people that don't know a lot about. You know, when you ask someone who doesn't know much about birds, what's a home for a bird? They're going to tell you with the nest, right? That's what people say. Oh, like, that's where a bird lives, in a nest. They're like, well, that's not really, right? Well, nests are really just for raising babies. It's the nursery. It's not the home. It's a small part of the home. And so when they're done with that, crows will sort of switch their behaviors from being wanting a lot of room and not wanting anyone too close. It's time to, you know, to party. So the kids are out of the house, like, woo, let's party. And so they will gather in large numbers. And it's believed that gathering in large numbers does really two things that are really important for a group of birds, particularly crows. One is that more eyes on patchy food resources means that you're more likely to find it, right? So if you're looking for, you know, a tree that has lots of, you know, ripe fruit on it that you can eat, or you know, a bunch of garbage cans that weren't put away properly, or a field full of fallen food crops, you know, like, having more eyes out to find those things means you're more likely to find them. You're more likely to get the food you need. And during the winter time, when food is less abundant, that's really important.
It's interesting that they cooperate and tell each other where the food is. You know, if there were people, probably wouldn't say it. They'd probably keep it to themselves.
Well, you know, I think, you know, in some ways people do have those same kinds of behaviors because, you know, people, when you're out in the world, you know, you look at what other people are doing as a clue to what you should be doing. And so birds are sort of doing that same thing. It's like they're looking at, you know, you see another bird making towards a food source and like maybe there's something good there to eat. And here's the other issue, right? So it's not just about the positive of finding food. It's also about avoiding the negative of predators. So when you've got, you know, a hawk or a great horned owl that might make a meal of you, you know, more eyes on that is also helpful. So you know, if you've got a big murder of crows out there, that, you know, somebody's going to notice that red-tailed hawk before it makes a meal of you. And in fact, that the hawks you know, get ganged up on. It's called mobbing, and the crows will, you know, by the dozens will, you know, chase off any raptor that enters in the area. And the same is true for, you know, great horned owls, which are a nocturnal predator of crows. If an owl found a roost of crows, you know, and it managed to catch one sleeping, that would be, you know, a good breakfast for an owl and not such a good news for the crow.
Well, given the number of crows that swarm into town in winter, there would not seem to be all that many predators of them, true?
Well, they're actually, you know, owls and hawks are actually doing okay in our area. And so I think the issue is that it works. It's like when you gather in larger numbers, that you are less able to be attacked by predators. And I think that our urban spaces have, you know, created new opportunities for crows. So it's not just that that the crows can gather in number, but urban spaces are often better lit. So that artificial lighting at night, actually, although it can be problematic for migratory birds, is a benefit for roosting birds like crows, because it just makes it that much easier for them to spot a potential predator at night. So crows will actually, you know, prefer to gather in, you know, groups of trees in urban spaces that are lit than in a rural place that's dark, mm-hmm. because they get the extra safety.
And I suspect there's a lot more food in an urban space as well.
Right. The way that we manage our landscapes, first of all, you know, if people are gardeners like me, you know, there are all these amazing exotic plants that you want to put in your garden because they are beautiful and they have, you know, red fruits on them in the winter time that remind you of the holidays, and you know, there's a meal for a bird that wouldn't have been there, right? Our native plants don't have as much of that sort of off-season abundance. By picking and choosing plants from around the world, we've actually created sort of environments that work for some species and not for others. So we plant things that have enabled crows to move into urban places, that have enabled mockingbirds to spread north to Canada. So all of these kinds of landscape changes affect where birds are. We also, our buildings and roads retain heat in a different way than a natural landscape does. It's called the heat island effect. So urban places are warmer, you know, and if you have to survive through a cold night, even though, you know, frankly, it doesn't actually get cold here in California. But, you know, if you're a crow and it's 40 degrees out in the suburbs and it's 42 degrees in the city, that extra 2 degrees, you know, could be, you know,
right. Well, you would see that up north, you know, where I came from, Montana. You would see the benefits of being in town as opposed to being out in the prairie, for sure. I can understand. The other thing about cities is that we throw away a lot of food.
We do indeed. And we're frankly not very good about doing it neatly. So, you know, actually that food waste is a big bonus for many organisms, not just crows, but all of the food waste that ends up, you know, on our streets, in our garbage cans, and eventually in dumps, you know, it creates an attractive nuisance for birds.
Mm-hmm. And they're very good at making use of that, of course, because they're smart and they're domineering as all heck. My uncle used to have a pet crow. And it was amazing how intelligent it seemed to be. Are they that intelligent?
Crows are among the most intelligent birds. I mean, parrots are pretty smart too, but you know, crows have been demonstrated in the wild. This is not being trained by people, right? To use tools. There are very few animals that use tools aside of people. Crows will use these little twigs to pry insects out of, you know, places that are hard to reach. Crows have a tremendous memory. There's a fascinating studies up in the Seattle area where they were actually had people wearing masks that were harassing crows, and the crows would see the mask and know that it was, you know, the harasser, and would behave differently than if it was somebody who didn't have that mask on.
And that's such a great show. I hosted John Marsloff, who was the author of the In Company of Crows, and he told that story, and it was so amazing because what was really amazing, of course, is that the crows recognized the person in the mask, but they recognized it year after year after year,
and even individual crows who hadn't been actually exposed to that person would know that was, you know, a troublesome person. So they were communicating, not just learning it from year to year, but passing it on to their offspring, passing it on to their neighbors, right? These are very social birds that have, you know, societies that are structured and that they communicate amongst themselves in ways that we barely understand.
Well, yeah, I was going to ask, how do they tell each other that that guy over there is bad? And tell all your friends about it. How do they do that?
You know, I don't know, but it's just amazing. And I know that there are, you know, there are scientists who are like John Marsloff, who are studying crows because they're so fascinating. And you know, it's an opportunity for us to learn more about even about our own selves as we you know, come to understand how other societies function. That there are, you know, there are benefits to our own. And yet, at the same time, I understand, you know, that, you know, if you've got, if, you know, 1,000 crows roosting in your backyard, they are noisy and messy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, I personally would be thrilled, and but I can imagine that my family would be less thrilled than I would be. they might whine a bit about being wakened by the crows or the mess to have to clean up. I mean, you know, you're parked
under a... Is that what upsets people? Why are the people of Sunnyvale upset that the crows have moved into town?
Well, I can only imagine that it's the mess and the noise. Those are the sort of the obvious things. You know, to me, the season is short. The when you see, and listen, I remember the first time I was working at the New York Botanical Garden in the Bronx, and I was there, and it was a time when there was a large murder of crows that roosted in the Botanic Garden every night. And I walked out just as they were coming in one evening. And I mean, usually I was, you know, long on my way home, but this was wintertime. I was leaving late, whatever. I was leaving just at the right moment. And, I mean, I would have probably 2,000 or 3,000 crows were arriving to roost in this set of trees. And you know, it was like zebras on the Serengeti, right? You know, this is like those, like, wonderful, you know, wildlife, you know, nature documentary moments, like, oh my goodness, this is incredible. But now if you had that in your backyard every night, you might get a little tired of it.
There you go.
To me, this is transient. They're not here all year round. I have a lot more tolerance for this probably than most people, given that what I do for a living. Should be not a surprise. But I guess I get it, you know, and I think that, you know, there are a few lessons that have been learned, because, you know, this is a growing problem. I mean, when I looked at our Christmas bird count data for crows, it was very obvious to me that there is actually a significant increase of crows in the Bay Area. They weren't, you know, when we first started doing Christmas bird counts 50 years ago, there weren't so many, and now there are a lot more. I mean, it's orders of magnitude more birds.
Do you see them supplanting other species of birds?
I don't. Again, they're here for the winter, and so, you know, they're at a time when other birds aren't really nesting in these places. They're not really competing for resources with much of anything else. And the reality is that regionally, these birds have always been here, probably. I don't know that the overall population of crows has grown so much. They've just shifted how they're using the resources. So instead of, you know, it being, you know, on the border of some farmer's field in, you know, the Central Valley, they've moved into a more urban space.
All right.
Probably they're also getting less... less negative human interactions as well, because a farmer, you know, is going to be worried about them eating his crops or her crops. And, and the farmer, you know, could then go to the Department of Agriculture and get a permit to kill them, right? I mean, you can do that, even though they're protected birds, because they are potential crop pests. You can actually get a permit to kill them. And so people used to do that.
Yeah.
And crows are, as we said, are very smart, so it probably wouldn't take a crow very long to learn best not to be there.
Right. Now, there are a couple other considerations as to why city people might not appreciate a murder of crows moving into their neighborhood. And one of them is the possibility, of course, what else do we think about these days other than the transmission of germs? Are they Typhoid Marys, those crows?
Well, more canaries in the coal mine. Crows are particularly susceptible to West Nile. And so that murder of crows that roosted at the New York Botanical Garden, when West Nile hit New York, which was right about that same time, the population disappeared. I mean, the crow population in the New York area plummeted with West Nile, because it was just killing them all. So In some ways, having crows in our backyard is actually a good thing, because it'll tell us, as long as they're there, we know our systems are healthy.
Okay.
It's like when they disappear, that's when we should start worrying.
Where did they go? Yeah. And then, you know, the final thing that crosses my mind, of course, is what Alfred Hitchcock did to us with the movie The Birds. And there's something spooky about those crows. And then, of course, there's the ravens in Edgar Allan Poe. So, you know, the crows have always been kind of portrayed as being spooky. What do you think?
I think that's a very Western culture attitude towards crow. You know, so the indigenous cultures in North America revered the crow as a sacred bird. And I think that we could learn something from, you know, the original stewards of these lands. And,
Well, the Crow Indians must have seen something positive in them, I guess.
Well, a lot of, you know, crows are sometimes, you know, credited with having brought fire to Earth, which wouldn't surprise me that they didn't help with that in some way. It doesn't seem beyond a crow's intellect to actually use fire as a tool, just the way the native peoples here used fire as a tool to manage landscapes. But Hitchcock sort of did us in, right? It's hard not to see a large flock of birds and not get a little nervous.
Well, we're going to have to take a quick break right now. But when we come back, I'd like to ask Glenn, how the heck do you get a murder of crows to leave town once it comes into town? Is it possible? This is the Food Chain Radio program. Right back.
Duke the Pug will soon turn 20, which is pretty good for a dog breed that averages 11 years. When Duke was 13, he lost a lot of hair, had a hard time getting up for a walk, and his bowel movements were not very moving. We started making his food instead of buying it. We cook up a big batch of rice, chicken, broccoli, carrots, and turmeric, freeze meal-sized batches, and thaw them at mealtime. We also sprinkle Arthrodex on each meal. Arthrodex is a complete blend of plant-derived minerals, vitamins, amino acids, and enzymes formulated to make old dogs young again. And it does. Duke the Pug does have his problems, but he has all his hair, loves daily walks, and has no problems with his movements. Breakfast is at 7, and if it's not there by 7:01, we all hear about it. Make your old dog young again. Pick up Arthrodex at NutriensToGo.com. And while you're at it, make yourself young again with a Healthy Body Start Pack. NutriensToGo.com. NutriensToGo.com.
We're on the farm with Joel Salatin.
Would you like to buy homemade soup, backyard chicken, and the neighbor's artisanal lunch meat? The Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund protects your right to acquire the food of your choice from the source of your choice. I'm Joel Salatin from Polyface Farm, and I urge you to defend the right of neighbors to engage in direct food commerce. Join today at farmtoconsumer.org. The food of your choice from the source of your choice. That's farmtoconsumer.org. Farmtoconsumer.org. Thank you.
You can earn a substantial income by farming for the city. All you need to do is take your crop to market and win the competition for the consumer dollars. There is a well-proven strategy for winning this competition. You will find it embedded in MetroFarm, the guide to growing in or near the city for the city.
Northland Berry News, Paul Otten.
What a book. It's obvious MetroFarm was not written by someone sitting in an ivory tower. It comes from the trenches, from the School of Hard Knocks. A superb job.
Ag reporter Nancy Barr. MetroFarm addresses just about every issue involved in planning, planting, growing, harvesting, packaging, transporting, and marketing of a crop.
Before you plant your seeds, pick up a copy of the Ben Franklin Book of the Year award-winning MetroFarm. Then plant your seeds and win the dollars. MetroFarm.com. MetroFarm.com. MetroFarm.com.
When you buy local American-grown flowers, flowers will grow and flourish in America. Hello, I'm Deborah Prinzing, author of Slow Flowers for Certified American-Grown Flowers. When you buy local flowers, you're helping our country's family farms reduce the transportation footprint of flowers and enjoy fresher, longer-lasting bouquets. So please, next time you shop for flowers, think local. Think Certified American-Grown Flowers. Visit AmericanGrownFlowers.org to learn more.
So much to say, so little time to say it. On the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, the little town of Sunnyvale, California, nestled as it is in Silicon Valley, has been taken over, some say, by a murder of crows. City fathers and city mothers are scratching their head going, what the heck are we going to do about these crows? Now, there was a little town called Riverton, Wyoming, up there in the Wind River country that was once inundated or taken over by a murder of crows and completely covered the town, covered the little town at a time when it was going to have an annual winter festival of some kind. And so the city fathers and city mothers did everything they could think of, which given the countryside there was probably had a lot of shotgunning to chase them away, but nothing seemed to work at the time. So when the festival came around, what the city fathers and city mothers did was they got a bunch of umbrellas and handed them out to all the tourists who flocked to town to see the murder of the crows. Funny how that thing worked. So we're talking today with Glenn Phillips, who is the executive director of the Golden Gate Audubon Society. And people must ask you, Glenn, what do I do? What advice would you give the people of Sunnyvale, California, on how to manage their crows?
You know, people often do ask, what do I do? I've got this problem with birds. And you know, very often, and I would say in this case especially, that, you know, prevention is the key. You know, once that murder of crows has moved in, they're very hard to get them to move on. But if you can prevent them from arriving in the first place, prevent them from thinking that your place is the most special place they could possibly be, then you're in much, much better shape.
So the moment you see that first crow land in the tree and look at you?
Yeah. Yes, that's even before then, you know, sort of maintaining our landscapes in ways that, you know, that are not creating, you know, potential for nuisances.
So and this is looking at Sunnyvale and saying, this is where you made a mistake.
Yeah,
because you didn't prepare.
It was last June. It wasn't now.
Okay.
It was last summer. So last summer, they should have, you know, looked at where, you know, where they have, you know, lighted trees. You know, if you've got a grove of redwood trees and you put these beautiful lights on them so that they pop in the landscape, well, you've just created a hotel for crows. So when you invited them, well, of course they came.
Do crows actually like redwood trees?
They do. They like tall trees that, you know, because they provide shelter and cover, and they like the light because that will, you know, reduce the risk of predators like owls. So a grove of eucalyptus trees, a grove of redwood trees, really any trees will do. They often will roost on taller buildings so that that if you have, you know, a nice sheltered location of buildings that are a little taller with a nice view, like making that less hospitable by reducing the nighttime lighting, by if you have to use pigeon spikes to, you know, encourage birds not to roost there, that's another tool. Making sure the food isn't there too, right? Because they're, as we said, these are opportunistic birds and they're very smart and they learn. So making sure that, you know, that places where food waste could be exposed are well managed so that that doesn't happen. They're really important. You know, if you do that and it still doesn't work and they're still coming, so at the beginning of the season when they're first arriving is still, that's the time to take a more proactive approach, to do things like adding noise, movement, light, that's not just like not brightly lit lighting, but you can use, you know, lasers and other things like that to just startle birds away from their potential roosting spots.
Yeah, let's pick up some of them because they're kind of interesting. Let's start with visual deterrence. What if you put up a plastic owl, for example? How long would that work? Maybe a minute?
Yeah, you know, these are really smart birds. So a plastic owl is, you know, they'll learn very quickly that it didn't actually chase after them, and so therefore it is actually not a threat.
Is there any visual deterrent that would scare away an owl other than something that's real?
Well, you probably could have success with a crow, a dead looking crow, right? So like those Halloween ornament style, you know, I wouldn't recommend using a real dead crow for this purpose, but you know, these are social birds, so they're, you know, they see an injured looking crow thing, you know, that's going to have more of a long term impact on their sense of security than a potential predator that doesn't move, right? Because they don't expect a dead crow to move.
There you go.
That's like, ooh, there's something that's killing crows here. Maybe it's not so safe here.
Yeah, back in the bad old days, farmers and ranchers used to, take out coyotes, for example, and hang them on the fence, so that other coyotes would see it as a no trespassing sign there. What about sound deterrence? What kind of noise can we make to chase away a crow?
Well, you know, so the key thing is that it can't be too predictable, right? Because as we said, these are really smart birds. So if it's, you know, if you had a recording of an owl sound or a hawk sound, and you set it to play every 2 minutes, like, they're going to quickly learn that, yeah, that's not actually a real threat. But so things that are sort of more random, that are more more surprising, are going to be more effective. There's one story of a town, I'm not even sure where it was, where they gave people like noisemakers and party hats, and you know, it's like they just went out and into the streets and hadn't made a lot of noise, and it completely worked. The crows didn't like that, you know, that humans were honking and using noisemakers and just making a ruckus. It was again not predictable. It was a human, so it was, you know, a potential threat.
It was kind of like the student who was dressed up in a Halloween costume walking across the campus. Where did that come from? I can't handle that.
Exactly.
Wow.
So the surprise, the suddenness, you know, that, again, unpredictable. You know, humans are pretty good at being unpredictable, actually. So actually just getting some people out to create a disturbance is a good tool. Again, works better if you do it right when the roost is forming, when they've been there for a long time. They just may feel too comfortable to be easily pushed on to a new spot.
Yeah.
And you have to think about, so if you push them off of one spot, right, where are they going to go? So
if you
just push them from one
spot,
they're just going to go next door, right? So you have to really watch, you know, you have to be systematic about this, right? Because, you know, again, these are smart birds. As birds, they move around. They, you know, as the crow flies, you know, the next house around the corner might be just as fine. So you have to really sort of take the time to be systematic and to think about, okay, like, here's an okay place. Like, it would be all right if they roosted there. We're not going to disturb that spot because it would be great if they went there because it wouldn't bother anybody. But this backyard, that park, these are places where we want to, you know, move them on from if they start to settle here.
It would almost be like you would have to organize the entire neighborhood to conduct a campaign against the sparrows. Much like Chairman Mao did back in the days when he initiated a Smashing the Sparrows campaign, everybody in town went out with their pots and pans and banged on the noisemakers until the poor sparrows were so freaked out they flew up and then they just fell on the ground and that was the end of them. But it would almost take something like that, a coordinated effort to use sound to move a murder of crows out. because they're very smart. And if one person does it, they're just going to laugh at you, I would suspect.
Yeah, I mean, it might move them off of your yard and into some other place, nearby. But if you really, if you don't want to just, out of the frying pan into the fire, moving from one place to another that's not necessarily better, you have to take a regional approach to this. It's part of why, that the U.S. Department of Agriculture actually has a division that manages human-wildlife conflicts, mm-hmm. because it does need to be done in a broader way. It's not something an individual should just decide, ooh, I'm going to just do this.
Because it isn't going to do much good. Now, Sunnyvale has hired somebody to run around and shoot at the crows with a laser. Well, if anybody's going to have a good laser, it's probably Sunnyvale, because they're right in the heart of Silicon Valley. So well, do you have any idea how that would work?
Well, those are good. It's a good tool, right? I mean, it's the, birds are very sensitive to light. That they have great vision if they have to fly. And so they, can perceive light in ways that we don't even see. They see, ultraviolet light birds see. We don't. So they have very, very sensitive vision. And that's a good way to create a disturbance to something that's unusual and unexpected that could cause them to question whether it's a safe place to be. Again, you have to do it sort of systematically. You have to know we're trying to move them off of these places, and if they're going to go there, that's okay. Again, you need to be, these are protected birds, right? I mean, we think of... crows are abundant right at the moment, but they are nevertheless protected by the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, and so they it's actually against the law to as an individual to harass them. You need a permit to do that.
Wow. Sunnyvale then has to go get a permit from the government to harass the crows out of Sunnyvale and into Palo Alto.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. Well, so how did you come to love crows, for those of us who don't? What was it that you found in crows that enriched your life?
Well, what's interesting is that what first got me interested in crows was the challenge of learning to identify ravens and crows, and then in New York there was a third species, a fish crow, and so there were three really large black birds, and they're not so easy to tell apart. And so there's as a biologist, that's really a challenge that requires solving, to figure out how to tell these different species apart. And so that was the first sort of my first introduction to paying attention to them was, getting called on having misidentified, a crow as a raven, or a raven as a crow, or a fish crow as an American crow. And I was like, oh, this is embarrassing. I have to learn this. But when you start paying attention, then you start to see all these amazing behaviors, right? Because these are, they're easy to watch. They're not very afraid of people.
For sure.
So you watch them, taking their food and washing it in a bird bath. And why are they doing that? We still don't really know. I mean, nobody really knows. The theory is that they're probably actually, because they tend to do it more when conditions are very dry, that they're actually trying to wet the food to give it to the chicks actually get more water.
Oh.
That's cool. But that's a behavior I can observe in my backyard. I don't have to, go on an adventure to see it. They're right here. You can watch the social interactions. Like the other day, it was sort of late summer, early fall, and the crow family had fledged its young, and the Cooper's hawk family didn't raise their young right in my backyard, but were, maybe half a mile away. Well, the baby Cooper's hawks, babies, they're the teenagers, right? They're all fledglings. They're flying around, so they're not babies anymore. But they were all in my backyard, and they were not happy with each other. So they were chasing each other and screaming, and it was like rumble in the jungle. I mean, this was like they were not happy, and they were making a lot of noise and chasing each other around, and it was really exciting to watch. And so the more you pay attention to them, the more you start seeing these examples of behaviors that you wouldn't see, you know, if you didn't know to pay attention for them.
If you're not watching, yeah. If you're not watching, life goes by without you seeing it. That's that. So as part of the executive director of the Golden Gate Audubon Society, do you folks have any means by which we tenderfeet could come to appreciate birds more than we do now?
Well, absolutely. So Golden Gate Audubon has a proud history of introducing people in the Bay Area to birds, and we run hundreds of field trips every year, and they're almost all free, and they are places where you can, you know, meet other new birders and be tutored by an expert, and as you go, as you sort of develop your skills, you'll find there are different walks have different focuses, and so you'll if you're new, maybe going to watch shorebirds isn't your first step.
There you go.
Start with an urban park where you can, you know, we have regular walks in urban parks all over the Bay Area.
Bring a binocular and an umbrella and enjoy the birds, right? Well, Glenn, thank you so much. Glenn Phillips, Executive Director of the Golden Gate Audubon Society. This has been the Food Chain Radio Program. And folks, remember Michael Olson's second law of the food chain. The farther you go from the source of your food, the less control you have over what's in your food. Thank you, Glenn.
It's my pleasure.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.